What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, President Trump arrives in Israel with a message from the Muslim world. If Israel wants peace with its Arab neighbors, they'll have to compromise with the Palestinians. And Michael Flynn has been out of the White House for 3 months, but his saga continues. Plus, the Islamic State is claiming credit for a deadly explosion at a concert in Manchester, England. It's Tuesday, May 23rd.
Dan Panorama Yerushalayim, shalom, medaberet Shiran.
Shalom, I'm trying to reach a guest named Peter Baker, B-A-K-E-R.
What is the last name?
Baker,
Baker, like bakery. Okay.
Hello.
Peter.
Hello there.
Peter, yesterday it was Saudi Arabia. Where am I reaching you now?
If it's Monday, it must be Jerusalem. So here we are. We're in the Holy City, and President Trump is here to make peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
יש לי הכבוד להזמין את אורחנו המכובד.
And it feels like right away.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Honorable Donald J. Trump, President of the United States of America.
The president made some pretty significant news in Israel. What happened?
Well, he did. Look, he took on this very, very vexing problem from the very start. Literally, the minute he gets off the plane.
Thank you, and shalom.
He gives a short speech at the airport.
Mr. President, I appreciate the opportunity to learn about your thoughts and vision.
Then he goes and meets with Israel's president.
Most importantly, the United States and Israel can declare with one voice that Iran must never be allowed to possess a nuclear weapon. Never, ever.
And then gives a longer talk in which he basically says, if you want to reorder the Middle East as you have talked about, that is to align yourself with the Sunni Arab states against your mutual enemy of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
There is a growing realization among your Arab neighbors that they have common cause with you and the threat posed by Iran. And it is indeed a threat. There's no question about that.
There's a price to pay, and that price is you have to make peace with the Palestinians. That's what the Arabs are telling me, and that's what I'm telling you.
On those issues, there is a strong consensus among the nations of the world, including many in the Muslim world. I was deeply encouraged by my conversations with Muslim world leaders in Saudi Arabia.
He just came from Riyadh, where he met not only with King Salman of Saudi Arabia, but with literally dozens of leaders from the Muslim world. And what they, you know, they bent his ear, obviously. They gave him their point of view of the Middle East. They gave him their point of view of Israel. And he's obviously communicating that now to Prime Minister Netanyahu. So he's telling the Prime Minister here that there's room for change, that, in fact, the Arab world is ready to accept Israel because they have this mutual enemy, Iran. But there has to be progress on the thing that will be difficult for them to accept, which is the continued occupation of the West Bank and the Palestinian people there.
So do we think, Peter, that the president genuinely changed his perspective on what it's going to take to put together any kind of Arab-Israeli peace deal? Or was this all part of the plan from the start to come from Saudi Arabia to Israel with this message?
Well, he clearly is learning. I mean, this is all new to him. I mean, you know, he's never been a politician before, much less a president. Understanding the intricacies of Middle East peacemaking, you know, requires time on the ground, requires exposure to the people who live it every day. And over the 4 months that he's been president, he's had a number of these leaders to the White House to meet. And he has learned over that period what their needs are, what their requirements are. And he is a deal maker. He clearly is taking that on board and trying to figure out, okay, this is what these guys need, what do these guys need, and how can we make them reconcile? Now, that doesn't mean he's going to be able to do it. But, you know, he's making an effort, and that's, a different situation right now in this region. So what he is doing is called the outside-in approach. It's not new, but it means that instead of trying to create a deal between the Israelis and Palestinians and then use that to create peace between the Israelis and their Arab neighbors, go the other direction. Try to get the Arab neighbors on board with the idea of recognizing Israel, creating a new relationship with them, and that would then put pressure on the Palestinians to come to the table and create an actual deal.
So the way his thinking has changed is that you cannot just pressure the Israelis and the Palestinians to make peace with one another. You have to involve their Arab neighbors to also put pressure on the Palestinians and maybe on Israel too.
On both, because Israel has something to gain here as well as the Palestinians. Israel wants to be friends, or at least, not enemies, with the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Qataris and the other Arab states around here, with which it does not have diplomatic relations. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that happened today was Air Force One flew from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to Tel Aviv, Israel. That's never happened before. Mm-hmm. No plane has ever, at least publicly, flown directly from Saudi Arabia to Israel. But the Palestinians also depend on these Arab neighbors as well. They have something to gain here, which is that they provide them with support of a financial nature and a political and cultural nature. The Palestinians couldn't survive without the Arab support that they get. And the Arabs are tired of this problem. They want it to be solved and to go away. They don't get excited about the Palestinian cause anymore. They just want everybody to sit down, come up with a deal so they can move on, because they're focused on Iran, which they see as the real hegemonic aspirant in this neighborhood, and one's creating problems in various countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and so forth.
So what was the response from the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Donald Trump's host, when Trump basically prodded him to do something that Israel may view as kind of at the request of these Muslim neighbors?
Well, it's interesting.
I want you to know how much we appreciate the change in American policy on Iran.
What you heard from Prime Minister Netanyahu afterwards was a lot of agreement about the part about Iran.
I believe that together we could roll back Iran's march of aggression and terror in this region, and we can thwart Iran's unbridled ambition to become a nuclear weapon state.
And no words at all about the Palestinian issue. There's a reason for that, because even if he wanted to himself, he leads a fragile coalition government that includes a lot of right-wing parties, settler parties that are not interested in any kind of deal, and that want him to basically tell Trump to go away if he forces him to.
Peter, has any of the controversy back home in Washington followed the president to Israel? Last week, The Times reported that Trump told top Russian officials about highly classified information relating to a threat by ISIS that we later learned had been provided to the United States by Israel on the condition that we not share it, and nevertheless the president did share it with these Russian officials. Is that hanging over this trip at all?
Well, it did come up today, as a matter of fact, when he was meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu. One of the reporters, Margaret Talev, asked about this question.
Mm-hmm. Just so you understand, I never mentioned the word or the name Israel. Never mentioned it during that conversation. They were all saying I did. So you had another story wrong. Never mentioned the word Israel.
The president said, look, I didn't say the name Israel. I didn't use the word Israel. So when you guys say that, it's a false story. Now, we didn't actually say that. That's not what the story said. What the story said was that he gave enough information about this intelligence about an Islamic State plot that a keen observer, a smart intelligence agency like the Russians have, could put it together and figure out where the source came from and therefore endanger the Israeli source of information. Now, Prime Minister Netanyahu is very intent on this not blowing up this visit. Very important for him to have this visit go smoothly. So even though a lot of officials here in Israel, particularly in the intelligence agencies and security agencies, are mad about this breach, he has made a point of not saying anything about it publicly, being as warm as possible. And when he was asked about it, he said,
"Your intelligence cooperation is terrific.
Thank you. Intelligence sharing is terrific. It's better than it's ever been." So he's trying very hard to downplay this as a dispute.
Peter, thank you very much. We will no doubt check in with you in a couple of days, and I hope you get some sleep.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye. We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for the New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray, and that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Did you just publish?
It literally just published, yeah. This is what we were just working on.
Okay.
Why don't you pause for a minute and give it a quick read?
Okay. Matt Rosenberg came into the studio in Washington with the latest on President Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn.
So we've got two things. The first bit of news was that Flynn has now rejected a subpoena from the Senate Intelligence Committee to hand over documents relating to any contacts he may have had with Russians between like 2015 and the election. Mm-hmm. So that was like the big news of the day. And then late today, the top Democrat on the House Oversight Committee, which, by the way, if you don't understand all these committees, neither do I. Half of us don't. But, you know, they exist. So the House Oversight Committee, the top Democrat is this guy named Elijah Cummings. Mm-hmm. He's been pretty aggressive on the Flynn situation. And so he released a letter today indicating that Flynn misled Pentagon investigators about his income from Russian companies and contacts with Russian officials when he applied for a renewal of his top secret security clearance at the beginning of 2016. So every 5 years, if you have a security clearance, you have to get it renewed. After you retire, generals and other kind of senior officers are accorded what they call courtesy clearances, mm-hmm. where they're allowed to keep their security clearance. And it's really important for them because it opens up incredibly lucrative jobs with like government contractors. Mm-hmm. And so at the beginning of 2016, Flynn's clearance was up for renewal. He'd retired 2 years earlier as head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. He was forced out of the job by the Obama administration, but mm-hmm. took his retirement. And now, early 2016, he's got to renew the thing. He did not tell them that the year before he'd taken a number of payments from Russian companies, including $45,000 to give a speech in December 2015 in Moscow for RT, which is a Kremlin-financed news network,
right.
And also attend its kind of lavish anniversary dinner at Moscow where he was photographed sitting at the elbow of Vladimir Putin. He just sort of left that out. And the reason this is important is because if he is found to have actively misled the investigators who do the security clearances, that's a serious felony that carries up to 5 years in prison. I mean, it's a big issue. And this sort of adds to his legal woes. You know, the Separate Justice Department investigation is scrutinizing his work he did later in 2016 when he was already advising Donald Trump, secretly lobbying for a Turkish government on behalf of this third-party company. Failing to properly register for that is another potentially serious felony as well.
Matt, how does all of this relate to what we already knew about Michael Flynn's relationship with Russia that got him fired from the Trump administration in the first place?
I mean, it kind of adds to the noise about it. I think we already pretty well deeply knew he'd had pretty extensive contacts with Russians. He was fired for misleading people within the Trump administration about conversations he'd had with the Russian ambassador at the end of December. Mm-hmm. So on December 29th, the Obama administration imposed sanctions on Russia over the election interference and took a bunch of other measures. The way we understand it, we've been told, is Mike Flynn throughout that day and into the next day had multiple conversations with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, where he appeared to kind of talk the Russians off the ledge, say, don't worry, it's going to be fine, we'll be in power soon, we're going to work this out. Mm-hmm. Now, who knew what and when they knew it within the Trump administration about those calls is still very much a subject of speculation. But the Trump administration says that he did not tell Pence and others. And Pence at one point went out and said he never had those conversations.
Right.
And so when it became public that he did, he was fired basically for misleading Pence was the reason given.
So this feels like the third or the fourth revelation about Flynn in just the last couple of weeks. There was something a week or so ago about President Obama warning Donald Trump against hiring Flynn, which leaked out. So is this starting to look like essentially why in the world would the Trump administration have ever hired Michael Flynn?
Yes. So I'm going to insert myself personally into the story here for a second.
You may.
I've known Flynn since 2009 when I was covering Afghanistan and he was the intelligence chief there. And I got to know him pretty well. You know, I think up until October or November this year, he would have told people we were friendly. And I think those of us who knew him then, and I was talking to somebody recently, were amazed that he was national security advisor. Mm-hmm. We would never have guessed he would have ever had that job. And we're even more amazed that he's now at the center of a scandal that is threatening an entire presidential administration. But the reasons we would have thought he would have never been national security advisor are all the reasons why we're not necessarily surprised he's at the center of this scandal. Look, he was this roguish, maverick-type character right. within the military who would break rules and he'd give intelligence to all kinds of people that he wasn't supposed to. And he always saw it as, I'm making the system better.
So he just went his own way.
He always went his own way. And so the fact that he went his own way on this stuff is not entirely surprising, but it is one of those reasons, like, why was he hired? Why wasn't their background check more thorough? Mm-hmm. And I think it speaks to how the Trump administration viewed people that, who were loyal to the president. Flynn was probably the only brand name general that really stood up for Trump early and stayed with him for the whole campaign.
Lock her up. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Lock her up.
I mean, Flynn was out there at the convention leading chants of lock her up, lock her up. The idea that a former general was leading chants about a former U.S. senator and secretary of state just horrified his peers in the military.
Damn right. You're exactly right. There's nothing wrong with that.
When he retired, he was considered one of the probably best military intelligence officers of his generation. And I think even through his firing, I know a lot of former military people who would say, you know, okay, we don't necessarily agree with him, and it's good he's gone, but let's be respectful. Right. He served, and he did his duty honorably. But I've seen the Facebook posts from some of these guys. When all the avalanche of stuff that's been coming out since March started coming out, their view of him was like, forget it. Like, we're done.
You know,
say whatever you want about
him. You know why we're saying that? We're saying that because if I... A guy who knows this business, if I did a tenth of what she did, I would be in jail today.
So, Matt, as someone who knew this man very well before now, help us understand exactly what's going on now that he's become a central figure in this investigation. How do you make sense of his role in this investigation as it started to heat up?
Well, I want to state up front that he hasn't spoken to me since late October. Mm-hmm. And he's referred to me as an adversary to mutual friends. So, And, you know, in a lot of ways, I find this kind of sad. You know, this is a guy who got out probably a bit too ahead of himself and maybe into something that he wasn't quite ready for and was with a group of people in the Trump administration who seem to have not given a lot of thought to how you lay out your life if you're going to serve in public office.
Right.
You know, in the 2 years after he left the Defense Intelligence Agency, he started this Flynn Intelligence Group, this private business, and they did a lot of work that wasn't going to look good. Mm-hmm. You're doing business with RT, sitting next to Vladimir Putin, lobbying for Turkey without disclosing it. These things all look terrible. And so it's hard when you leave government life or leave the military to go out and do what you want and then come back into it if you haven't carefully chosen what you want to do.
And if you don't honestly disclose what you've done. So let's come back to the Senate subpoena. Why do you think that Michael Flynn is now refusing this subpoena?
So we've got the letter that Flynn sent to the committee, and it said that the congressional investigations plus the appointment of the special counsel last week had given Flynn, quote, a reasonable cause to apprehend danger, unquote, should he comply with the subpoena. And then it goes on to say he's the target on a nearly daily basis of outrageous allegations, mm-hmm. often attributed to anonymous sources in Congress or elsewhere in the United States government, which, however fanciful on their face and unsubstantiated by evidence, feed the escalating public frenzy against him.
So he feels he's not going to get a fair shake.
Exactly.
Matt, what happens when you refuse a subpoena? And by the way, if you wanted to do me a favor and tell me what a subpoena is,
all right,
then so that would be helpful too.
A subpoena is simply an order by a court, or in this case, Congress, that orders you to hand over materials they've asked for or to come and testify. If you refuse to comply, you can be held in contempt of Congress. Mm-hmm. It's unclear if Congress is going to do that, what steps they'll take. You know, contempt of Congress is a political decision as much as it is a legal decision. Mm. And so right now, we're not quite sure how Congress is going to play this.
Why might Flynn participate in one of these many investigations but refuse to participate in another?
Well, the thing is the FBI and Justice Department investigation could put him in jail. Mm. Congress can't. So if there's anyone he's going to try and cooperate with, it's going to be the federal investigators. It's certainly been suggested that he wants to cut a deal. I mean, he offered to testify to the Senate Exchange for Immunity. We have no reason to believe he had not made the same offer to the FBI. We're told they don't want to do that because he's seen as a major target, one of their main targets, the investigators. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to like let the top guy off and give him immunity and he can implicate people beneath him. At least that's their thinking. You know, we don't know anything about his innocence or guilt here. But I think that ultimately if you're deciding, well, there are three different investigations, the one you're going to cooperate with is the one that could put you in prison.
Why do you describe Flynn as the top guy? Why does everyone want to hear from him?
So he was somebody who was with Trump through the whole campaign. He had numerous contacts with Russian officials. He also appears to have potentially committed other serious felonies. You know, for the Justice Department, you think, okay, if he knows anything, we can flip him with this because he's looking at real jail time here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the Justice Department hasn't given him immunity yet.
Mm-hmm.
So they may just think we can charge him with all this other stuff. Just a quick note. When you want immunity, the FBI does something they call Queen for a Day, where they bring you in and you tell them everything you know, and it's all off the record. It can't be used against you later. And that gives them a sense of, okay, is this somebody we want to give immunity or not to? Which I just love the name Queen for a Day.
Yeah, why not King?
I guess the king is the guy who's going to put you in jail.
Matt, this has been quite a surprise and really fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Finally, around 10:30 p.m. on Monday night, a massive explosion went off inside the Manchester Arena, a concert venue in northwest England where a performance by Ariana Grande was just ending. The arena had been filled with young teenagers, there to see the 23-year-old performer.
This has been the most horrific incident we have ever faced here in Greater Manchester, and one that we all hoped we would never see. Families and many young people were out to enjoy a concert at the Manchester Arena and have very sadly lost their lives. Our thoughts are with those 22 victims that we now know have died, the 59 people who have been injured, and their loved ones.
Greater Manchester's Chief Constable, Ian Hawkins, spoke in the early hours on Tuesday morning.
We have been treating this as a terrorist incident, and we believe at this stage the attack last night was conducted by one man. The priority is to establish whether he was acting alone or as part of a network. The attacker, I can confirm, died at the arena. We believe the attacker was carrying an improvised explosive device, which he detonated, causing this atrocity.
It is now beyond doubt that the people of Manchester and of this country have fallen victim to a callous terrorist attack.
Prime Minister Theresa May spoke on Tuesday.
An attack that targeted some of the youngest people in our society with cold calculation. This was among the worst terrorist incidents we have ever experienced in the United Kingdom. And although it is not the first time Manchester has suffered in this way, it is the worst attack the city has experienced and the worst ever to hit the north of England.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.